You're listening to episode 24 of the Tennis Vows podcast with special guest Stephen Warboys.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey everybody, Mehrban here, and welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files Podcast. I really appreciate all you guys tuning in today, and I think today is going to be a pretty interesting episode for you guys to listen to, because we've got Stephen Warboys, who is a former ATP pro and former number one ranked junior in the world, and he reflects on tennis back in the day. So Stephen played a ton of legends back when he was playing on tour. He played Connors, Vilas, Armitage, and you know, a bunch of other players that he's going to talk about on the show. And it's just interesting to get a perspective from Stephen on how the game was played back then and the differences between the game now and before. And Stephen is also a radio personality. He commentates on TSN, I believe, on the International Sports Report radio show. And so he's just a really cool guy. Really enjoyed talking with him and, you know, getting his thoughts on the pro game and some of his favorite pros as well. So, yeah, I just hope you guys really enjoy the interview today. Super cool to talk to Stephen. And without further ado, here is my interview with Stephen Warboys. Hey everybody, we're here with Stephen Warboys, who is the head tennis professional at the Toronto Cricket Skating and Curling Club. He is also a commentator for the International Sports Report radio show, and he has actually has been ranked as high as 73 in the world on the ATP Tour, and Stephen is a former number one ranked junior in the world as well. Stephen got to the junior finals of Wimbledon. And he also got to play some amazing legendary players like Jimmy Connors, Guillermo Vilas, and Stephen Armitage. Stephen, I just really appreciate you being on the show, and I want to welcome you to the podcast.
It's a pleasure, and very happy to be talking tennis with you.
Thanks so much, Stephen. So I just want to start with the beginning of your tennis career. So where did you grow up?
Grew up in London, England. Played a lot of tennis there on grass courts and obviously indoors with the weather in England. Started playing pretty early on in life too. I had a racket in my hand by the time I was three, but I spent my early years in London.
Fantastic. And how did you get your start? Did anyone in particular influence you to start playing the game, or did you just pick up a racket randomly and trot on the court?
No, there's nothing random about it. Both my mother and father played. My father was a pretty good player. He qualified for Wimbledon before the Second World War and then qualified again afterwards, after obviously a break of a few years. And he was not a young man when he qualified. I think he was probably 36 when he qualified the first time and probably 42 the second. And he got there the hard way. He was not a top-ranked player in England necessarily at that time, but he was good enough to play the singles at Wimbledon. He started so late, obviously, when you get that good at that stage of your life. You can see how late he started, being 36 playing at Wimbledon. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make sure with me that he started as early as possible, and he was my formative coach. And I had a few other coaches a little later on, but he's my formative coach till I was about 14 or 15.
That's truly fantastic to have a father to reach as high as a level as that, so he could coach you and advise you into how you could grow into that elite level of the sport. And so I'm sure your father was also an idol of yours, but did you have any other tennis idols growing up?
I did, and they would have been primarily probably British players at that time in my sort of early teens. I used to go to watch some Davis Cup matches at Wimbledon, and always watch very closely players like Bobby Wilson, Sangster, Mark Cox, Roger Taylor. a little bit later on. Now, some of those earlier names, Mike Sangster, for instance, was a great player, a great basketball player, but a lot of your listeners might not have heard of a player from that time going back. My idols, when I really, I wouldn't say so much my idols, but the players that I admired tremendously once I started to play professional tennis in my mid to late teens, were really the players like Ilya Nastasi, Bjorn Borg, who I was quite friendly with, Jimmy Connors. That was really my era, although they were all just a little older than I was.
Certainly legends of the sport. And going back to your father, I'm just curious, you know, given that he reached such a high level, I'm curious, you know, what kind of tennis dad was he as far as, you know, was he more on the tough side or relaxed, you know, when you're playing?
He was pretty tough, but he'd be pretty tense when he watched me play. He was probably a little ahead of his time because he, in those days, we're talking in the early 1950s or late 1950s when I was very young, people weren't devoting quite the time to getting their children to play sports, particularly with the objective of having them play at a professional level. My father had that idea, I think, very early on. Mm-hmm. And went about it in a very sort of complete way. He covered a lot of bases very early on, and he really had me on a full program, which at times wasn't always fun, I have to admit. But he was pretty tough.
Oh, I mean, that's great. It helped you reach, you know, a great level. And I'm also curious, did you ever feel, you know, a lot of pressure to become a great player, given that your father was just such an excellent player himself?
Yeah, I think so. Not so much maybe about his playing standard, but I guess really about the way he went about it. It was very well publicized in England. It was almost like, I guess, a little bit of an experiment into the time and effort he put in to sort of helping me with my tennis. And then, of course, more so when you start to win as a junior, then the pressure starts to build because I won tournaments very early on and started winning some national championships and even some senior events in my mid-teens. So then now the pressure starts to build, but it's, of course, more put on you by yourself than anything else, right? But the expectations were fairly high.
Right. And I'm curious if you could take us back to your very first tournament experience, kind of describe that, how it was like.
Oh, that is interesting. The first one I truly remember probably is about 6 or 7, very, very young. I played at a fairly big tournament. It was played across England, actually. Matches are played in qualifying stages at different areas. It was probably an under-12 in that, maybe an under-14 in that. And I remember a young man, we actually had a tennis court at the house. We had a grass court tennis court at the house. Yeah. And a young man showed up to play this match and agreed to, rather than playing at the club, he agreed to come to the house and play on the grass. And he was a tremendous young man, but he wasn't much of a tennis player. And life had not been quite so kind to him. He struggled a little bit with many things. But actually, over the years, we became friends. And I won't tell you the score when I played him. But we actually became friends, and he became a very proficient tennis player and a very successful businessman, too. So it started a friendship. That match that I probably remember more than anything else really in my career started a friendship that was kind of special.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, tennis is just such a great sport for all the wonderful people you meet and the connections you make, and they, you know, in a lot of cases, can help you out later in life. So that's fantastic.
Sure, it does. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just curious also, what part of your junior career did you feel that you experienced the greatest improvement, and how did that happen?
I guess fairly early on, I sort of started to grow into my body and grow into my game a little bit. Eventually, I ended up sort of playing. In those days, of course, we played almost primarily a lot faster than what the professionals are playing out there today. So I started to grow into my body a little bit. By the time I was 14 or 15, I was pretty tall. I like to serve and volley. That was by nature my game, to attack. And at that stage, I started to sort of feel comfortable with what I was doing, although, of course, struggled mightily, particularly early on, playing on slower court surfaces, particularly on clay. That came a little bit later, that confidence to play sort of reasonably well on clay. But my game was primarily an attacking game. So about the age of 14 or 15, I started to feel that I had the game to compete at a sort of a higher level.
That's fantastic. And would you say that you had a big serve, or was it more of a that you placed it very well, allowing you to serve in volley, or was it both?
No, I had a big serve. I had a big first serve. I could hit the kick. I could hit the slice. And that was really, I guess, partly what I was talking about there, about growing into my body, being able to hit all those serves too. You had to have a little bit of height, some strength, and sort of in my mid-teens, I really started to feel that I could do that. By the time I first qualified for Wimbledon, I was 16, I had pretty good control over my serve, and I would say it was close to being a world-class men's serve at that time. It was a very important part of my game. I volleyed well, obviously. I had a good forehand, which was normal in those years. My backhand was a little suspect for world-class play, and I always had to work on that very hard.
Did you have a one-hander, Stephen, or was it two-hander?
Yeah, I was a one-hander. And for those of you listeners that are interested in the technical parts of tennis, course, which we are, I was a continental grip player, so I just played off of one grip, which was common in those days. That you didn't even have the eastern forehand and backhand grips, and definitely nothing like the western grips you see today, which obviously are so strong and so pronounced. So I played my professional career basically off the continental grip, which really helped with the serve and volley and allowed me to do a lot of different things with the racket, but became a little bit of a liability on the backhand for me.
Mm-hmm. I am also just curious, this is a long time ago, obviously, but do you happen to remember the model of racket and strings that you used, at any point in time between your junior career and pro?
You better believe I do. You remember those, when you play tennis for a living, professionally, you remember all the details. I played with the Dunlop Maxfli for many years. It was obviously a big racket in England and around the world. Slightly modified, half inch shorter. Not that you could do that much to the wood rackets, but it was very specific about grips and grip shape, tapered grip and half inch shorter. And of course, in those days, we're playing with cup in the racket, a natural cup, which was VS primarily, a battle of VS.
And so, given that the natural gut was used by all the players, was it still as relatively expensive as it was today? Do you remember?
Yeah. In fact, I'm not really sure if you do a price comparison from now to back then, whether the price is actually, that the real price has actually changed that much. It was always expensive, and obviously still is today. I think it was probably more expensive when I was playing in the true value of pounds or dollars. It was even more expensive. And it was, of course, it was hard. If you're practicing a lot, playing a lot, you're still going through a fair amount of rackets, although we didn't take onto the court the same amount that they do today and change the rackets every 6 or 8 games. But even with 4 or 5 rackets, going through them fairly regularly, it was an expense. And of course, if you didn't have a sponsor to help, it was it would have been tough.
Yeah, and you just mentioned sponsors. Was there a general range of what ranking you needed to achieve to have a sponsor in those days, and is it different from today?
Yeah, I would say it was different. I think, obviously, the money was really shifted towards the top in those days, both in what people had played for guarantees to play, because I started playing before the era of open tennis. I actually played the first open tennis tournament in Bournemouth, England, but before that, we were playing for guarantees. And, if you didn't have sponsorship, it was tough. But I would say probably the top 40 to 50 players had a chance of making a reasonable living. Maybe the top 20 or 15 made a really good living. And the sponsorships might go down a little bit lower than that, but not that much. Where I was lucky is that I was fortunately a world-class junior player and therefore got access to sponsorship at a much younger age. On the chance that I might be able to continue that on as I became a senior in the professional ranks. So I had sponsors very early on in my career.
Oh, this is wonderful, Stephen. And so what do you consider your greatest achievement to be as a junior player?
Oh, well, I guess in the under-18s, I won all the national titles in England, the indoors, the grass courts. I did not win junior Wimbledon, which has always been one of the greatest regrets of my life. I lost in the final of junior Wimbledon, and I also lost in the final of the French juniors too, which to me will always sting. In those days, we played a major junior Davis Cup event called the Galea Cup, which I'm not sure is played anymore. It's probably defunct. But it was for under 21 players, and basically it was designed on the same lines as Davis Cup, 4 singles matches over 5 sets, and a doubles match in the middle. And that was for European players only. But in those days, of course, a lot of the very strong players were from Europe. So when I played in that, Bjorn Borg was playing, Jose Higueras was playing for Spain, Corrado Verzuti playing for Italy. Anyway, there was an awful lot of strong players at that time playing in that. It was the preeminent event for under 21 players. And I was lucky enough or fortunate enough to be on a team where England won that event. And at that time, and even before then and after then, we had not had much success at that sort of level. And we actually beat Spain in the final, and I won both of my singles matches in five sets, one of which was against Jose Higueras, of course, went on to become at least a top 10 clay court player in the world, if not a top 10 player, full stop.
Wow. Wow, that's really amazing. Congratulations on that one.
So I finally found out how to play on clay, but believe me, I still couldn't really do it week in and week out.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough for a certain value. Did you end up staying by the baseline at least for some points, or did you still continue on with your game?
No, that's a good question. I obviously had to modify it, but it was still a flat-out attacking game. It's funny because I remember an interesting story. I won the match. My last singles match was actually the fifth rubber, and it was against the other Spanish player, not Higueras. And I was locked in a huge battle over five sets, and finally got up 5-4 for the match. The captain was on the courts in those days, just like David Cup, and I was up 40-30 on my serve, and I missed my first serve where I was going to serve and volley, and I'd been kind of mixing it up. I'd half serve and volley and half spend the time at the back of the court and try to work my way in. And I suddenly had this sort of flash at that particular moment. Why don't I serve and volley on the second set and try to get this match over? And the captain told the story for many years. He said, I saw Steven serve the second serve, and I looked at the baseline to see where the next shot was, and I couldn't see him. And next minute, he's up at the net and shaking hands. So, you know, you always go to what you feel comfortable with, I guess, under the greatest pressure you can have, and that's what I did.
No, that's actually wonderful advice. And could you perhaps give us one tip for, and I know this is not the biggest subsect of players right now, but for serve and volleyers who want to succeed on clay, what is one adjustment that you would advise they make?
Boy, that's hard, because you play, particularly on the red clay courts these days, of course, I think everything's slowed down a little bit too, so serving and volley, I think, on a clay court is brutal, even for the greatest servers in the game today. But if a club player wants to try it, and maybe playing on Hartrue, on North American Hartrue, it's a little easier to serve and volley. I think the big thing is you just can't rely on speed, because you're just not going to be, you know, that court sort of thing. Is you just got to move the ball around a little bit or get the ball in the body if you're really going to be successful trying to serve and volley occasionally or sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. I'm curious, you did mention the sponsorships and such, but how did life change, if at all, when you became the number one junior in the world?
Well, I picked up more sponsorships. I picked up a clothing company to go with the rackets and some other sort of fairly lucrative deals for that particular time. I guess more than anything else, I started getting invitations to play tournaments. I mentioned it before. In those days, we were playing for guarantees. You'd actually get paid to show up. Started receiving more of those, and then started to get to travel around the world playing for guarantees. Nothing like obviously the top 5 or 10 players in the world would get, but enough to make a living and to feel comfortable that you could make a living at the game. Also started to get into some of the tournaments that maybe I hadn't been able to play. And this is just before the ATP ranking started. So I played right through that when Open Tennis started. And then when the ATP ranking took effect, there's the first official world ranking. There were world rankings before then, but of course they were unofficial and maybe not quite as accurate as they are today.
Mm-hmm. And so now shifting to the Pro Tour for you, can you just talk about what your career was like on the Pro Tour and, you know, the difficulties and successes that you've had?
Yeah, well, I guess the big difference, and it would have been in that era and that era only, but it was always something. It was always a sort of a decision to make, where I would play on a weekly basis for a guaranteed income to show up at a tournament. Obviously, you'd want to play well because then you get an invite back again the next year and maybe the guarantee would go up. Or whether I would chase ATP points with no guarantee, no monetary guarantee whatsoever, mm-hmm. Put up a fair amount of money to do so. So the tendency, unfortunately for me, was to stay more in Europe, not to always travel where I probably should have traveled to try to improve my ATP ranking. For instance, I never went to Australia, which is a place that not only I think I would have played fairly well because there was grass court tournaments there, but I think I would have enjoyed tremendously. But I always stayed and played in Europe indoors because I knew I could make better money there. So I never really got to play probably all the major tournaments. I played the US Open, played Wimbledon 7 times, but I probably never got to play the majors that I should have played. And looking back, I probably wish I'd done so.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Well, that's very interesting how that all worked.
It's very different to what you have today, believe me.
Yeah, no, indeed. And, that brought up in my mind. I'm curious, do you have any idea when they started the Futures and Challengers Tour? Did they have any sort of similar tournaments to that at all?
They really didn't, because you sort of didn't need them, right? You had smaller tournaments and bigger tournaments, and obviously Wimbledon was one of the bigger tournaments, but it wasn't the same way. You didn't need qualifiers for professionals in those days because A, there weren't that many playing, and B, there just wasn't the money around. This has all come obviously because of the money that's come into the game. And to actually just point that out, and I always think this is interesting when I tell people, they seem to be quite surprised. The last year I played in Wimbledon, I think, was 1976. And I won a round at Wimbledon that year in the singles. I lost to Jimmy Carter in the second round. I think I won 2 rounds in the doubles, and I got handed a check for $1,200. If you went around this year, Wimbledon just coming up next week, if you were in a one, went around in the singles and went 2 rounds in the doubles, I think you're probably going to get a check for about $80,000.
Right.
And I know money translates differently, but the money just wasn't there when I was playing, and that's the big difference.
Huh, yeah. It's still tough, though, for the lower-ranked players of today, but like you said, there were far less players back when you were playing.
It was impossible back then. It really was.
yeah. And curious, you mentioned Connors. If you don't mind, could you describe kind of what it was like to play against Jimmy Connors?
Yeah, Jimmy, three players I played against, the best players, maybe four, they were all very different. When they started, Vivas, Borg, and Connors. Connors was particularly interesting because he probably played with one of the worst tennis rackets I've ever seen made. And I have to be very careful saying that because I'm a Wilson professional and they make incredible product right now.
Right.
But he played with that Wilson T2000. I'm not sure how many of your listeners ever saw that racket, let alone play with it. But it was actually the hardest racket to play with in the world. It had a sweet spot that was the smallest sweet spot you've ever seen. The racket would shake if you missed it at all. And it was just a really tough racket to play with. Now, he had the game that fitted with that because he was probably the flattest guy I've ever seen through the ball. Mm-hmm. He really didn't hit the ball with top spin or underspin. I know it's impossible to hit a ball flat. There has to be some spin on the ball. But basically, he was straight back and straight through forehand and backhand. And actually managed to play with that racket and succeed with that racket. And to me, that actually marks him down as one of the greatest players of all time because it was such a brutal racket to play with. I can't explain how tough it was. And he actually carried on playing with that racket past. Wilson eventually told him that we will not pay you anymore to play with this racket because it's out of production. And he was still playing with it to the bitter end. It's really quite interesting.
Wow. Yeah, I just Googled the racket, and it looks like it's 50 square inches or something like that. I mean, it's really...
It was a round hoop of steel with two steel sort of prongs attaching the handle, and it, It was just terrible. And he played with it. He played beautifully with it. He was also, of course, one of the greatest competitors of all time. Like a ferocious competitor. Mm-hmm. Just loved to play, loved to win, but just loved the whole part of competing. And would you trick in the book to work you over on the court? Mm-hmm. I actually started Jimmy playing golf a little bit because I'm a big golfer, and I was with him in some of these very early rounds when he started to play golf, and he was just the same way on the golf course. All of a sudden, he's running on the golf course because he's such a competitor.
Yeah, you hear about champions who are competitive at everything, and I heard that about Nadal before as well, and I'm sure there's countless others. Between Nastasi, Vilas, Borg, and Connors, I'm curious also, who did you match up best against, and who gave you the most trouble?
Well, they all gave me a lot of trouble. Unfortunately, my record doesn't show too well against any of them. At the end of the day, playing Vilas on a clay court was brutal because he hit with mm-hmm. such huge topspin. Borg, the same thing, although I played Borg and Connors close to three times. But with Borg, it was a very interesting phenomenon because he was the first guy to really work topspin to the level that he did. And Vilas, of course, did the same thing. Up to then, tennis had been, there was obviously topspin in the game, but it was nothing like the amount of spin that those guys put on the ball. And Borg actually almost semi-mishit the ball most of the time. He played with fairly tightly strung rackets. And he gets so much spin on the ball, he almost had this little semi-mishit. So for me, coming to the net against him was particularly difficult because a lot of the times these passing shots would seem to be a little high, but of course they dip down very quickly after that. So that was easy, that was tough to judge. You play Connors and I'd come to the net against Connors, it would just be a clean pass. It would either be in or out. It was very clinical. Mm-hmm. But Borg, it was tricky. With Nastasi, he was one of the great racket handlers probably of all time. I think his game would translate today, although probably most of those guys' games would too. But he was probably the biggest artist I've ever seen with a tennis racket.
Wow, very interesting. Great stuff. And so, Stephen, what was your fondest memory as a professional on the tour?
Oh, funny enough, later on in my career, I actually picked up a couple of tournament titles. They weren't at the very top level, and I won the Irish Open in the very last year before I retired. I only played 7 years on the tour. I turned pro at 16, and I was already on my first teaching job at 23. So, and I said before, I played 7 Wimbledons in between. But after I started my first teaching job, and I was in Miami Beach in Florida, I picked up a tournament called the Florida Citrus Open, which was one of the bigger money tournaments outside of the sort of the major events. And I won the Irish Open that year too, both the singles and the doubles. And over the years, there've been some pretty good winners of the Irish Open. It was always played the week after Wimbledon, so they got a fairly strong draw from players that have played at Wimbledon. I think those probably for singles events, they were my best recollections. Although that Goliath Cup that I won as a junior also ranked very high.
Well, that's fantastic. And Stephen, I know you played 7 years on the tour, which is fairly substantial. But at the same time, you did retire at the age of 23. You mentioned. So, do you have any regrets over retiring that early?
I really don't know that. I could have maybe gotten a little better. There's no doubt about that. But my game had limitations, and I realized, unfortunately. And although I tried to address them, it was probably, and improve some of my weaknesses, it was probably a little bit too late to really do a remake on a shot. Like, I could have gone to a double-handed backhand, or I could have started really making some major grip changes, and I decided that I really didn't have the time to do that. So at the end of the day, no, I really don't have any regrets. It would have been nice to play another 2 or 3 years, without a doubt. But I was offered a very good teaching position. I was very fortunate to get that at 23, and I've been mostly teaching ever since. And it's something I enjoy tremendously. I love the technical aspect of the game and very much into it. And I've had a great career. You know, there was never the money around for me in those days, even if I'd moved up from 70-odd, whatever I was, even if I'd moved up to 30 or 40 places, there wasn't going to be enough to make a really good living anyway. So I'm very happy with actually the way it turned out.
Well, it's fantastic, Stephen. And I mean, 7 years is, again, I mean, that's a great, I'm sure you had unbelievable experiences.
The experience was incredible. It really was. Traveling just worldwide and the people I met, I mean, just played in so many fantastic places, made so many friends. It really was. It was a treat for 7 years.
Fantastic. And Stephen, I mean, these days there's a lot more focus on eating healthy and physical fitness. And I'm just curious, on the tour back when you played, did you notice that as well? Was it as much of was it as prominent as it is today?
Well, you couldn't say it was prominent, but people were definitely very aware of it. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Although, of course, the running joke was the Australians drank a lot of beer in those days and were still incredibly successful on the court. But you know what? A few beers probably wouldn't harm anybody.
Yeah,
I think diet, people were careful about their diet, but they were definitely not in the physical shape that today's players are. They've moved it into an absolutely different level. And you see Djokovic out on the court today. I mean, it's one of the finest physical specimens, one of the finest athletes I've ever seen in any sport. And they weren't at that level. But in their own way at that time, yes, they did. They did work on it. And a lot of the players were extremely fit.
Yeah, and you know, I know that you're born in England, and then now you reside in Toronto, which actually one of my teammates, former teammates from college, Irfan Shemazin, and his brother Adil Shemazin, they're up there as well. But as far as you know, the tennis players, you know, you obviously, I'm sure, are a fan of Milos, and I've heard your bits on him as well as others. But who are your favorite players on the tour today?
Well, I've always been a big fan of Federer's Rogers. I just love the way he plays. I don't think anybody I've ever seen, maybe outside of Ilya Nastasi, played with the grace that Roger plays with. Hmm. Any person that makes the sport look easy to me is probably a pretty good technical master of the game, and Roger definitely has that ability. He plays so beautiful. It's so much fun to watch. I've come to admire Rafa over the years. Maybe not so much originally, because I'm not a big clay court player myself, right. But I think what a true gentleman he is, and I admire the way he attacks a game, and I admire the way he acts as a human being afterwards too, which to me is a wonderful thing. And Djokovic, just for his athleticism, and he also seems to be moving in a great direction as a person. I think Tanis is so very well served by that group of players. I think when we watch tennis, we should be proud of those three. So up-and-coming players, yeah, I like Milos a lot. I think he's missing maybe just one or two small parts, but I really don't think he's missing that much. And he could strike, even at Wimbledon this year, could have a very good Wimbledon. He's stuck in Djokovic's quarter, which is going to be tough for him. But I think he may have a major in him. He's a very hardworking young man. He attacks the right way, the game the right way. He's very, very professional. And I'm also kind of impressed with Dominic Thiem. I think Thiem may be a player to look out for going forwards as well.
Definitely, yes. Milos had a very close match with Andy, I think a few days ago, where he had a volley to go up 4-1. Might have just been one break.
Yeah, but he did. And funny enough, that was a Queen's Club, which is my old club in London. So it always gets me thinking of the good old, bad old days when I see the clubhouse, which really hasn't changed very much. But that match was good for Milos in many ways, because just to play close with Andy was good running into Wimbledon and to be in the final. A little bit disappointing after being up 3-0, he couldn't close it out. That's just one of those little things. He's not quite 100% there, but you know he is knocking on the door. And that was he was actually taking it to Andy for a good portion of that match. So he played very well.
Indeed, he did. And so, I'm curious, what in your view does Andy Murray need to do to overtake Novak Djokovic, if possible?
Wow. Yeah, that might not be possible. Andy Murray himself, I think, is a great athlete. He also covers the court very well. I think he's a great fighter. I think the one thing that's got to be very hard for him to challenge Djokovic is that Murray always looks to me to be a little disturbed mentally on the court. Mm-hmm. He always seems to find a way to get upset about something. And while many people would say that is something that might motivate him to play better, that tries to get himself juiced up, to me, it becomes a distraction. And I think that's got to be an issue, because I think that's just human nature. I think that's who he is. I hear he's a great young man off the court. On the court, I'm not sure I like the way he presents himself at times. Whereupon Djokovic, who used to suffer too a little bit from that, not quite the same way, I think has matured in the way he plays and matured in the way he looks at the game from a mental perspective, and is calmer and therefore takes less out of himself. And for that reason alone, obviously Murray's going to have a shot to beat him occasionally. But I think Djokovic is not only the physically maybe slightly quicker and slightly stronger player, he's also mentally probably the tougher. I think he also believes he's fitter than anybody else that plays the game. And that's a wonderful chip to have on your side of the table, if you really think you're fitter than the guy you're playing. And I think that's what Novak thinks about everybody he plays. So that's a tough combination. The physical fitness and the mental superiority is got to be hard to beat from my perspective, as long as he wants to play tennis.
Oh, certainly, and he's been doing a lot of stretching, and that's why he's so balanced and can get basically every ball hit on the court. And also a great point about the mental, you know, just the temper tantrums, because Federer, obviously, when he was much younger, he would also throw those temper tantrums, and he's learned to be even keel. So a couple more questions for you, Stephen. Your pick on who will win Wimbledon on the male and female side?
I hate to go with a guy who's the odds-on favorite, but I kind of got to go with Novak, I guess, if you ask for a single pick. I think Milos could have a huge time, but if Novak lost in an earlier round, and it can be tough at Wimbledon the first week, the courts can be green and the ball sits down and it's a little slippery and tough to move. But if Milos could somehow find his way past Novak for whatever reason into the semifinal, I think he could have a huge tournament. But I can't go against Novak the way he's playing. In the ladies' side, I'm a huge fan of the young Spanish lady, Garbiñe Muguruza. Mm-hmm. I think she has style, class, big, big game. I think the way she took it to Serena just recently, and just actually took her on at her own game in the French, where she virtually outsurfed her and outhit her. I've been touting this young lady for 2 years. She's got the softer side of the women's draw as a number two seed at the bottom. Serena's got a few tougher players, I think, earlier on. So even though Serena normally would be the favorite and my favorite probably to win any event she plays in, I'm actually going to go straight out with Garbiñe Muguruza and say I think she's going to win Wimbledon this year to her French title.
Very reasonable picks, Stephen. And I'm also curious if you could just briefly sum up how you got into commentating, because I know you commentated for the Olympics in 2012, and you also do that for TSN and ISR Radio.
Yeah. The gig for the Olympics just came out of the blue, literally. I think they came up short at the last minute with about 3 or 4 weeks to go. And a member of my club actually was talking to one of the producers for the Olympic Consortium up here in Canada. I said, look, we've got somebody right here at the club who has the experience, played at Wimbledon many times. And because the Olympics were held at Wimbledon last year, it seemed to be a good fit. So got the job. Originally, I was supposed to do just the Canadian content for the first, however long the Canadian players lasted. And then after, unfortunately, Milos had gone down, they asked me to carry on, and I actually did the event right through to the final. I did the semifinal, the men's and the ladies' singles too. I enjoyed it tremendously. Didn't really follow up on it probably the way I should. Not that I thought anything else would come of it necessarily, but I probably should have pressed that advantage home a little bit. But just in the last year or so, decided I'd like to get back and maybe give that another shot if I could. So ISR Radio suddenly came up and started doing a weekly show with them with a tennis panel, and now really I'm their go-to guy for tennis, and I'm on there most weeks. So slowly, step by step, you know how it is. You got to practice and you got to work at it, right?
Exactly, Stephen. Wonderful stuff. And so one question that we like to ask all our guests at the end of an interview is, what one piece of advice would you tell our audience to help them improve their tennis games?
I think there's two things. I think, first of all, most people are way too much interested in the outcome and not interested enough in the preparation they make on the tennis court, and it's all cause and effect. And I think if you want to get a good outcome, you want to win matches, you've got to work on preparation. I think tennis is 90% what you do before you hit the ball. So that would be the actual number one thing. The second thing is that most people are not aware of the angle of their tennis racket in their preparation or at impact. And in the days that I played, as I mentioned earlier on, with a continental grip, you're very aware of it because you didn't have grip change. So you're very aware of where the face of the racket is at all times. And I think that's something that most amateur players need to work on very hard, but primarily probably preparation, what you do before you hit the ball, rather than worrying about the result then. Where the ball's going and whether you're going to win the point.
Fantastic advice, Stephen. In particular, the racket angle. I have not heard that advice yet in asking that question to my interviewees. So, Stephen, where can our audience find and follow you?
Okay, well, the number one place always on Twitter, which is Warboys on Tennis. That's my Twitter account. And for anybody that ever wanted to get in contact, they can catch me at warboysontennis@gmail.com. or at the Toronto Cricket Club in Toronto, Canada.
Wonderful, Stephen. Well, I really appreciate you taking your time to talk to me. I wish you all the best. Thanks again, and you take care.
Thank you very much. Stay well. Bye.
You too. Bye, Stephen. All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed my interview with Stephen. And I would really appreciate it if you guys would leave a review for the Tennis Files podcast, whether that's on iTunes or any other podcast app that you use to listen to the show. I'm also, excited to once again be part of the media for the City Open tennis tournament here in D.C. And that's going to be about a week and a half-ish from when this episode is published. And I'm going to be at the press conferences, I'm going to be interviewing players and reporting on the matches. And I also am going to try to release a podcast episode or two live from the City Open. So I think that would be pretty cool. So I'm going to try to contact one of my media friends to have him do a show with me, a show or two rather. And I always like to end the show with a quote. And today's quote is from Marcus Garvey. And Mr. Garvey says, "A people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots." And I thought that quote was quite appropriate given the interview with Steve and how we talked about tennis and some of the great champions of the past generation, and how tennis is really such a neat game with a rich history that hopefully we'll live on for many, many, many more years and we'll thrive. So thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate you guys supporting the show and sending in emails. And I really enjoy corresponding with you guys. So please don't hesitate to shoot me an email at mehrban@tennisfiles.com. So that's mehrban@tennisfiles.com. Looking forward to having you guys tune in on the next show, the Tennis Files podcast. Until then, take care, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.